it's, when we're talking about new people who are going to be on MA, it's not just assuming the legislature just decides to expand Medicaid, our MA program. It's not just those expansion folks that are newly going to be on our Medicaid program. And it's not just people who are moving over, some of them, from Minnesota Care. People like between 75% and the 138 of the poverty level that we cover in Minnesota Care today. And that's why moving them to MA saves the state money. But we also have a number of people that we project will be on Medicaid because, partly because of the mandate, they will now be required to have insurance, and we think they're more likely to sign up. And we're going to streamline the eligibility process so it's easier to sign up and to stay on, and we have less churn. And I put a bullet on here that our estimation is that 145,000 Minnesotans will be on MA as a result of these changes. And these are a lot of people who are eligible for Medicaid today. And I make that point because while the federal government pays for the first 3 years 100% of those, you know, single adults that are newly eligible for Medicaid, those people who we believe, because of the simplification, are already eligible but not on MA, a lot of them come on MA, we end up paying half, you know, our regular FFP for that population. So when you look at your budget, our budget, you'll see kind of in our moving parts in the ACA, we save money through Medicaid expansion. We end up spending more money for people who are eligible today, but not on our programs, who we believe will be coming onto our programs. So that's a very high-level explanation. And I know that the committee has had informational hearings on the ACA and is familiar with much of this. So I'll just end there, happy to answer questions, and Assistant Commissioner Scott Lights will go into more detail as well. Beyond the Affordable Care Act, the second really large and critically important proposal in the governor's budget includes our package of proposals around what we call Reform 2020. I think one of the best things that came out of the 2011 legislative session was the direction from the legislature, and we very much agreed with this direction, to go and really work with stakeholders and others to redesign our home and community-based services. So a large and fastest-growing part of our long-term care system. You know, and we need to redesign it now. We need to redesign it in a way that makes it where we intervene earlier, we provide a broader array of services to keep people in their homes and communities and reach them earlier before they have, some of them have that need for kind of those deep end, more expensive services. We wanted to make it more consumer driven and help people during those transitions in life when we lose so many folks. There are a lot of moving pieces with this one. Overall, it actually saves money in the short term, more money in the long term. But I think it's not about taking services away from people. It's actually about intervening with more options earlier. This is important, though, because we think this redesign really sets up our system so that by 2020 and beyond, when the age wave really hits us hard, we will have a long-term care system that's prepared for it and that can continue to serve people, but do so in a much more sustainable way going forward. So this, I know you'll see a lot of pieces of this, but it's very important. We have to get waivers from the federal government for much of this. We're in negotiations with them now. And, you know, and we think we're off to a promising start. I think the federal government also realizes this is something that will serve people better, and it will save both the federal and state taxpayers money in the long term. Our next set of priorities when we were going through and reprioritizing our budget was really to put more of a focus on children. So we are proposing investments in early childhood. We want to take Parent Aware statewide. Parent Aware is a quality rating system for child care centers and for licensed home daycare centers. We put into the governor's proposed budget more incentives so that if you go to a Parent Aware rated facility or home daycare with more of those quality programming, then those providers get either 15 or 20% more in our child subsidy system, which we think is a real incentive for providers to become have more training and quality, which we think is good for kids. And it also, you know, is better for parents if they have more money that's being paid to providers, they have to make less of it up out of pocket. We have, you know, a number of smaller but important items really focused around what I see is one of the huge issues that faces our state, and these are teenage mothers on our infant on our assistance programs. You know, there are a lot of people that our infant program, which is our main assistance program, serves, and you know, a lot of them are only on there for a very short period of time. They're there because they lost their job. There's some immediate crisis. They're on our program for a little, and then they move on. They get jobs. They go back into employment. And then we have some people on our assistance programs who are there because of serious health problems that really do not enable them to get into the workforce at times. So we are working with a number of those. But I think
we have a question from Representative Norton.
Sure.
I was willing to wait till the end, but if...
Oh, you would rather... Okay, that's fine.
But unless we're taking them as we go. That would be fine. Thank you.
But we have... But there are also teenage mothers, and I think one of the most troubling statistics that I've heard since becoming commissioner is that 75% of those teenage mothers on our assistance programs, their mothers were on assistance. And so we really are trying to do a number of small things that we think are evidence-based, but to try and figure out what works to try and break that cycle of intergenerational poverty. So it's things like really intensive home visiting for new mothers who are on our programs. It's making sure they're first in line to get that child care assistance, which will enable them to graduate from high school, get into the workforce. So there are a number of things you'll see in our budget related to that. You'll also see proposals for children to double access to school-based mental health services, which kind of fits in both our mental health bucket and certainly our children's bucket, to really be able to intervene earlier and be more effective, to doubling those districts that receive that funding throughout our state. And there's a couple of things we're trying to do to make sure we do a better job getting children in our foster care system, and it's especially hard for older children into permanent homes. So we have some additional funding for that. Right now, the financial incentives are skewed, and Chief Justice Lori Gilday and I have been going around the state as part of our Children's Justice Initiative and asking people what could we do, you know, the court system or the human services system to do a better job getting permanent homes for these children, especially kids over six. And almost uniformly we heard, change the financial incentives, where the incentives aren't to serve someone in financial foster care, but to actually do the adoption. And that means also then we have more support for those families that adopt kids who have been neglected and abused, because those families need more support, and so do those kids. So you'll see some of those proposals, as well as an expansion of our parent support outreach program, which has been a very very excellent, evidence-based tested. We have it in a number of counties today, way to really provide more supports to families that are teetering on will they end up in our child welfare system or not. With these supports, we show we keep those children out of the child welfare system and they're in their homes more effectively. So it's a very cost-effective program in the long term as well. The next set of kind of priorities really deal with our behavioral health continuum. You'll see some of these. Some of them do not have large dollar price tags on them, and that's not because we're not actually investing dollars. It's because when you actually invest dollars more community-based services, you end up with savings kind of on some ends too, because then they're not being served at ANOCA as long perhaps. So we've really, you'll see proposals in addition to our school-based mental health that emphasize prevention and early intervention, more care coordination, more family education for, we want to expand our mobile crisis teams to more regions of the state. Those are mobile mental health crisis teams. We have them in 59 counties. We want to expand that. Once again, this is something we're able to help people more quickly, keep them out of hospital emergency rooms, and help them solve their problems before they become even bigger crises. And related to that is a set of proposals which really focus on building up our community supports so that there are patients in ANOCA now, our ANOCA Regional Treatment Center, and also at Security Hospital that we believe could be served in the community. People who are in ANOCA but beyond the time that they actually need hospital level of care. People at Security Hospital, some of them that are ready to leave, but these are not people you just, you know, send right into the community. They only can leave if we have the right kinds of supports, you know, the mental health supports, the housing supports. And there's sort of supports beyond really in some areas we're able to do today. But I think providing those supports helps in two ways. It gets these people who, if they're ready to be out of a hospital, can I just say, as a matter of just a person's rights, they should be. And also, then, ultimately, we spend less in the community than we do in hospitals. And we also opens up beds for people because we know they're waiting lists for people at Anoka. And those people are waiting often in community hospitals and sometimes even in jails. So this is really a proposal that gets at that. And then finally, you'll see a number of proposals around program integrity. I mean, since we created the Office of Inspector General to really try and centralize and beef up our program integrity efforts at the department last year, we've had some real successes, and we want to build on those. So you'll see, and this package is budget neutral overall. Some cost money. We need to do more internal audits at DHS. A ton of money goes through our department, and we need to beef up our internal audits to make sure it's being handled wisely. And that costs money. On the other hand, a number of our efforts really to strengthen our prevention and detection of fraud and going after fraud will save money. So it's a package overall that is budget neutral. And some, just finally, of our other initiatives you'll see, I mean, there are a lot of things in this budget, are focus on some funding for the county performance management systems. We're really trying to transition with the counties, and I think we're working well with them to actually have a system that focuses on outcomes. Instead of just having kind of process measures for counties, which drives them crazy, and some of them understandably, is really to try and shift to looking at outcomes. What are their outcomes for children in our child welfare system? You know, how many kids do they have, you know, for their population out-of-home placements? That if we can agree upon these outcomes, I think that's then we can really not have as many of the process measures, and I think we'll do a better job of evaluating how we're all doing in human services. You'll see some smart purchasing initiatives. We're really trying to move to pay for performance, across the department. And you'll see that is reflected in the increase we want. We provide an increase for nursing home rates. All nursing homes get a small part of that. But there's also the ability for those who are increasing, kind of using our pay-for-performance approach, which we already have, to get additional money as well. And we want to put into place to start introducing that for our home and community-based providers as well. So you'll see that number starts out small because it's really setting up a system so we can make additional dollars available to home and community-based providers based upon their quality improvement. So smaller dollars, and I think it's about $7 million, but you'll see much larger dollars, and I admit it, in the tails, because we think that those are providers that do need increases. We want to move as a department, though, to where we give increases to have it based on better outcomes. Our sex offender treatment program, I'll just say, what we provided in our budget is operational funding for the growing population. So it's almost $8 million that we're going to have to spend if we don't do anything more with this program and this population. Obviously, and I know that both Representative Abler and Representative Liebling are on a task force that's looking at other options. You know, this is money that could be spent on other options instead, but if we do nothing, this is money that, we do need to spend and have in our budget. So I would say that, you know, from the governor's perspective, you know, we really look forward to hearing more from the task force. We're very open to, you know, having those discussions, but we think it's only responsible for us to fund the projected growth in this program at this time. And with that, you know, I just say, Mr. Chair and members, you know, I understand that, you know, there are things we could have done differently and, you know, different choices to be made. I feel overall like this is a really good starting place. I think, you know, with our reprioritization, our ability to cover, you know, over 100,000 Minnesotans with health insurance, to do more for kids, to do more for our mental health system, I think we're real priorities, and I feel good about this. You know, having said that, I also understand you all have a lot of expertise. I think this is a good starting place. I really welcome ongoing conversation. I'm sure that there can be improvements. You know, I guess one other thing I would say is in terms of an overview, and I think I mentioned this when I was talked to the committee previously just about the department. You know, this budget is based upon a budget where we reduced Human Services spending by, about $1 billion off of the projected spending in the last biennium. You know, and one thing, with one exception that I'll note, that you don't see in this budget is not just, we're going to restore what was cut. This budget is based upon that budget. Those were hard decisions. Those were hard for those of us who had to make them. Those were hard for people. Those were hard for providers that serve those people. But overall, we think they were necessary, and this budget is not about restoring. It's about really reprioritizing and moving forward. I think one exception to that was the funding for Merck. We really felt, as looking at, if you're bringing 145,000 new people into our public programs, we have to do a better job. We have to make sure we have the workforce there who can care for them. And the Merck funding, we thought, was critical. You know, we want it focused on, you know, primary care training and making sure we can keep providers in greater Minnesota. We thought restoring that funding, it's about $12 million in the budget, was very critical. Another thing you will see in this budget are some fee increases for dentists and physicians and small ones for hospitals. Once again, we can give people health insurance, but if we don't have providers to take care of this, then we're all going to be in trouble. And that's what happened in Massachusetts. That's one of the things we saw, is a lot of people suddenly in 2006 were insured in Massachusetts, but they didn't have enough primary care providers. And we already know that we have a real access problem for dentists in Minnesota. So this will be the first dental increase in, 14 years, I think, across the board dental increase. So we do think those are investments that we really need to make this work. And I think the only thing I now realize I missed looking at Representative Norton, I do want to be sure and say that we also included $12 million through this reallocation process for a new benefit service package for children with autism. Once again, you know, maybe not a population that everyone, you know, 4 years ago or 5 years ago, we saw the great need that we see today. A growing number of children on our programs who are on the autism spectrum who have ASD. So there is that in this budget, which is something else we feel strongly about. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer questions for a bit, though I must say I have even more experts here who will be giving you a lot more detail about all of this.
Okay, we have a number of people that would like to ask questions for you. But first of all, I'd like to thank you for showing up today. And if I was your parent, which I'm not, I would have told you you're not going to work today if you listen to her voice. So thank you for showing up. And the first question is from Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Two things, and I'm appreciative that you touched on one of them, and it was the behavioral health continuum and early intervention and its importance. And I was just going to remind you that the children with autism are waiting for our help, and so I really appreciate you acknowledging that in advance. The question I had for you is with regard to Reform 2020. I'm looking for the timeline for approval from the Fed so that we're not counting on something that might not come, the what if, you know, what if it doesn't come? And so I was hoping you could address that for me.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, we've been very clear about the legislative deadlines with CMS. We did not anticipate any problems, but we've tried to make this so that if, for example, they approve one part but not the other, we've tried to package that so that our legislative initiatives are tied very closely. So if we didn't get that funding, that approval for one thing from the feds, then here are the things we would not ask to be funded in Reform 2020. So we've tried to anticipate problems, but, you know, if they occur with CMS, in the way we've just structured the budget proposal. But I think there'll be a few things they won't like. There are a couple of things which we think are going to be harder to get, and those are not things that we've actually put in this budget proposal. So we've tried to be mindful of that.
Representative Harden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a follow-up, I want to thank you for being creative and for not just maintaining the path we've always been on and going back to what we've always been doing. I think it's very important, particularly in this time as demographics are changing, that you make necessary reforms and changes and be creative. And so I really appreciate seeing that in this budget.
Okay, next we have Representative Morin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. And please bear with me, Chair and Commissioner, but I have a few questions that would help me to get a better understanding of the governor proposal. And I think the first question comes under the heading of safe and healthy development of children. And we had a presentation on housing yesterday, and I think in my question to the commissioner, maybe I didn't ask the question correctly. So I'm going to try this again. And so, as we know, as we look at out-of-home placement and foster care, there's a disproportionate amount of children of color in the system who are finding themselves, you know, in long-term care, and many of them age out of the system and become homeless and or incarcerated and things like that. And so I was looking at some of the healthy transition to adulthood programs you have going on, and just again, in your words, looking at, you know, redirecting and the priorities and looking at those who are most in need of help. Just looking at some of the statistics here of for the state fiscal year 2012 and the grantees served, they served 257 youth in foster care. But from those 257 youth that were served in foster care, 58% of those youth receiving services were Caucasians, 17% were Native Americans, and 8.6% were Black and African Americans. So maybe you can help share why there's such a large gap on those who most need the services, who are in that system in high numbers, are receiving the less of the services in foster care.
Mr. Chair, Representative Warren, I mean, I do think that in our foster, I'm not sure just what you're looking at, so it's a little hard for me to answer your question.
Mr. Chair, so what the commissioner brought to the committee yesterday were the funding for 2012 for transition to adulthood and homeless prevention programs. It states that the grantees that they have currently, there are, for fall 2012, grantee agencies served 257 youth, right? Of those 257 youth currently in foster care, 58% of the youth receiving services were Caucasian, 17% was American Indians, and 8.6% were Black and Native Americans. So I guess my question is, with such a high population of people of color in foster care and out-of-home placement, my question is, why is there such a large gap in those who have been serviced, youth who have been serviced? Does that make sense?
You know, if you want, you could look up the information.
I'd be happy, Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm happy to talk with you about this, but I don't know who said this, and I'm not sure what you're looking at, so it's very hard for me to answer that question. I mean, certainly, you know, a disproportionate number of children in our foster care system, you know, are children of color, you know, and they're the ones that have, for an example, some of the hardest times getting placements and getting those permanent homes. So a lot of what our initiatives are very much targeted at those children, but, you know, what specific program serves exactly that today, I would have to, you know, look at the budget page. Aaron Sullivan Sutton is will be presenting kind of an overview of our children and families budget. She's probably in a better position to answer that question, but, you know, I'm happy to, if she doesn't answer that question today, happy to do it myself, but I just would need to know what you're looking at. And who was, when you say a commissioner said this, I'm like, kind of, who?
Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So the information came from Commissioner Aaron Sullivan Sutton.
Okay.
So this is her data. So I will move on, and I will ask her again and once she presents. The second question is, I know the department have an urgency to place kids in permanent homes, and I guess I'm a little concerned for one reason being, again, we know there are a larger number of children of color being taken out of their homes, which is the breakdown of the family. And there's an urgency to get them out of foster care and put them in permanent homes, because we feel that permanent homes is the best solution to them being in foster care. and many times aging out, which I think is really abusive anytime someone is consistently in foster care for many, many years. So I'm glad we are at a place where we're looking to place them in permanent homes. But I was just thinking, what is your thoughts of, you know, I know you're also shifting to trying to do some reunification to help parents with trainings and give them the tools they need so that they can be reunited with their kids, and also doing a search for family members who can also support, you know, kids who are in the foster care. So is that a strong initiative of the department to do some reunification and also maybe place children with family members?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, I mean, those are very important to us. You know, we do have, as you mentioned, a number of initiatives where we're actually giving counties a lot more money and tools to do relative searches, you know, using new technology and other things so that we can do a better job looking for relatives for those children where we have to take them out of the home. The reason that, you know, I mentioned our parent support outreach program as being one of our priorities, taking that statewide, that is a program, and I could have said more about it, that really is about helping families stay together. And these are disproportionately the families we are helping, families of color in this case. So what that program does is, and you may be familiar with it, is it identifies families who are kind of come into, they're reported often for neglect or abuse, that sort of thing, and they've decided, okay, they don't quite make it to where we're going to, you know, put them in the child welfare system, start taking the kids out of the home, kind of, they're so-called screened out, but we know it was close, you know, and we know that there are really hard things going on in this family, and there are a lot of red flags, but it's not so bad that we think we should be taking the children away from them, right? So what this parent support does is identify where it's in place today. It identifies those families and gets them the extra support at the time of identification. So it doesn't just wait for them for things to go wrong. So it does much more of those wrap around services to keep the family together. And what the evidence shows is with this, we have much better outcomes for kids. Those kids who are part of this program are much more less likely to end up in the child protection system and in foster care and away from their families than families who didn't have access to that service. And that's why part of our reprioritizing within our budget has been that's a program that works, that helps kids. We want to take it statewide. And Mr. Chair, if I may, you know, and I apologize for this, but I have the legislative auditor coming to my office at 11 o'clock, so I am in a half. I apologize. To go pretty soon.
So, well, we're going to have a lot of staff going through the details so we can save questions for them. And so thank you for attending. And
thank you.
I would suggest you take some pills.
Well, Representative Abler's been getting the cough drops all
over. Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Thank you. So who's this? That late? Assistant Commissioner Lights.
I have one more.
Representative Moran has a question.
And maybe you can answer. Hopefully you can answer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this question is about the child care scholarship that the governor is proposing. And he is, and I'm a strong advocate for early childhood education. I believe it's a necessary tool to help children enter kindergarten more readily prepared and reading by third grade. But I have a question around access and availability and space. I mean, we can give people scholarships, but there's no availability or space. So does that or does that not just expand the waiting list?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that probably was it's a very good question, probably best addressed when Erin Sullivan Sutton is available, and I think she'll have a number of things to say probably in those areas.
Commissioner Sutton will be testifying next Tuesday. Next week, anyway. So, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Scott Leitz. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at the Department of Human Services. I'm going to walk you through the items in the governor's budget related to the healthcare administration. I'm going to be working off of the yellow packet of information that you have, which are sort of termed fast facts. But I'll also be cross-referencing it to the actual governor's budget change pages, which I think hopefully members, I believe, have a copy of. I'll start by on page 2 of the Fast Facts document, which is expanding medical assistance eligibility. There's really three items which are contained in this sheet, and they correspond to the first three items on page 5 of the first two items on page 5 and the first item on page 6 of the governor's change pages. The first item is changes that the Affordable Care Act requires states to make changes to their medical assistance program, particularly around streamlining and modernizing eligibility determinations for individuals. A number of the changes that need to be made relate to changing over to a new income counting methodology, the way that we count income for the purposes of determining eligibility in our programs. We have a requirement to do streamlined online application and verification things, as well as some improvements to our renewal process and a few other eligibility changes. The primary change as it relates to income counting methodology is moving from our current methodology to what's called the Modified Adjusted Gross Income, or MAGI methodology, which is really meant to mirror the way that income is counted for the purposes of tax returns. And so we marry up those two aspects. One of the things that is required is that the asset requirements or asset tests that we currently have in our programs need to go away, all the income disregards that we currently have are replaced with a standard 5% income disregard, and that's why sometimes you'll hear when I talk about the Medicaid expansion that it'll go up to 133% of poverty, but with a 5% income disregard, it's actually 138% of poverty. I think Representative Loeffler yesterday, you suggested we just adopt one or the other as our way of doing that, so that's a good suggestion. We also are going to be required to accept applications online by mail, by phone, or in person, and to use electronic data verification where we can. I think one of the pushes in this is to make it as easy as possible for people to apply for our programs and to use existing information. One of the burdens that we have right now is that people are required to send multiple documents, and we're really trying to do much more verification of that information electronically. Under this budget item, there's also changes that relate to how we do renewals in our programs, meaning how often we check for re-verifying information. Right now, that's on a six-month basis. This law, the law will be required to go to 12-month renewal periods. We're also required to expand medical assistance for former foster care children up through, if they're on the program at age 18, to extend that coverage up through age 26. And to allow hospitals to do what's called presumptive eligibility, where they collect a baseline amount of information and make a determination as to whether an individual is likely eligible for medical assistance. This ensures that at the point of care, those hospitals know that they'll be paid for the services rendered. And if we've done the process right and the individual ends up being even ineligible, then we do receive matching funds on that portion of it. These changes really apply to populations which are currently eligible for our medical assistance program, and therefore we anticipate bringing on an additional average monthly enrollment of about 64,000 additional people into the program. But because these are people who are currently eligible at our current matching rates for the program, there's a cost to this item about of $166 million over the biennium. The second aspect that we're required to do under the federal law is really what's called a maintenance of effort requirement. And again, this item is the second item on the governor's, on page 5 of the governor's change pages. We currently cover children in our Minnesota Care program up to 275% of poverty. And federal law requires us to continue to provide coverage at the same levels that were in place on the date that the Affordable Care Act passed. And so we've interpreted that as meaning because we operate the Minnesota Care Program under a waiver, a medical assistance waiver from the federal government, that these children would be medical assistance eligible on January 1st of 2014. And so the governor's budget makes that change, moving those individuals, those kids over from Minnesota Care into the medical assistance program. We estimate that there would be about 106,000 additional kids enrolled in MA as a result of this, about half of which weren't previously eligible or weren't previously covered by a public program, so likely uninsured kids will be coming onto the program. And the third item, which is the first item on page 6 of the governor's change pages, states are optionally allowed to expand their medical assistance program up to 133, with the income disregard 138% of the federal poverty guidelines starting in January of 2014. This expansion would include single adult populations between 0 and 138% of poverty, parents between 100 and 138% of poverty, and 19 and 20-year-olds between 100% of poverty and 133% of poverty. So these are populations that who are currently eligible for our Minnesota Care program or medical assistance where we receive our 50% match. For the single adult populations, if we take up this optional expansion as the governor is proposing, we would receive 100% federal funding for the childless adult population and 50% match for the parents and the 19 to 20-year-olds. One question I think that folks have asked is, do we need to go fully to 133% of poverty in this expansion in order to receive full federal funding? The answer that we've received from CMS on this is yes, that we would need to do a full expansion. The governor is proposing that. So this proposal assumes the expansion will move about 53,000 enrollees from Minnesota Care into medical assistance and add an additional 34,000 who are currently uninsured.
Could you give us the totals of the increased enrollment? How many are coming from Minnesota Care? How many are currently or would be eligible but not insured right now?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
For the total, for the three.
Sure. The total is about 145,000 new people who are currently newly covered people. I can also give you the breakdown, if you'd like, of folks moving from Minnesota Care into medical assistance, if that would be helpful. The first change that I mentioned, which is really the eligibility enrollment streamlining pieces, brings on about 64,000 newly insured people. And there's no real movement on that one from Minnesota Care to medical assistance. The maintenance of effort requirement on children, keeping them in medical assistance up to 275% of poverty, results in about 106,000 new kids coming on to medical assistance. About 60,000 of those were kids who moved from Minnesota Care to medical assistance, and about 47,000 of those are new kids being newly covered. And then on the expansion of MA to 138% of poverty, we estimate that about 87,000 new enrollees into medical assistance will come as a result of that. About 53,000 of those move over from Minnesota Care.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Oh, thanks. Well, now I'm more confused than ever. How many people that are not, just if you could just maybe give me a total number, and I appreciate you breaking it down, but how many people that are not now insured totally are going to be getting covered? Just if you could just say that number succinct so I can get it in my head right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, 145,000.
People that are not now covered are going to be covered in addition by this, and the transfer ones are a whole bunch of them, not part of the 145.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abreu, that's right. Of the 145 are newly covered individuals.
That were barred by asset limits or residency or just didn't get around to it or all those reasons?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ayler, it's a combination of things. Yeah. One is some of what you just mentioned there. There's also the impact of the requirement that individuals have coverage in January 14. Mr. Hoffman estimates that that will bring in some additional people into the programs as well.
Thank you. That's helpful to get a number. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll now next turn to the yellow sheet, page 4.
We have a few questions first, and I'll go through the list. This is from when the commissioner was still here. Representative McDonald, did you want to ask? You're on my list.
I made your list,
yeah,
Chairman.
Yeah, well, commissioner's not
here. May not be a good list.
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Light's question for you on page 17. 2 years ago when I first was, when you were in front of this committee going through the budget, I was impressed on the detail of the budgets, especially as a new young legislator, and I was able to follow spreadsheets in my previous career as in Delano, but so I was very impressed with the details of the budget. I find that this new budget spreadsheet's very lack of detail in it, and surprised that we would go back to such a budget that detail, that spreadsheet that has little detail. And I'll use an example on page 12 of the budget in front of us. If you could all go to that, talks about the nursing facility rate increase and the quality add-on, yet it doesn't give the percentage of increase. It just indicates that there's an increase. Well, then as I look further into the data, I'm supposed to go to this yellow sheet, says fast facts, and then I turn to that page and there's still no detail of the rate increase for the nursing homes, and that's what I'm talking about. So I'm just wondering, as you know, the fiscal analysts, as they look through this, and yourself, how you could find this useful when there's such a lack of detail in here and information. It doesn't have any numbers based upon the last two or three bienniums like our last budgets, which is very helpful so we can kind of gather how many people are going to be serviced, what monies are going to be increased from this biennium, from the last biennium, or the last two bienniums. I think as a legislator whose responsibility for helping with the finances of our state, those numbers are so important, Commissioner, and frankly, I'm not sure why we changed the method of the spreadsheet. Can you address that?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, and thanks for your comments. We certainly want to make information available. I know that MMB did do a format change this year in how they're presenting the budget documents across all the agencies. We'll certainly take your comments back to them and ensure that they're aware of them. And I might add, we certainly are happy to spend whatever time with members here and also out of committee helping you understand what's in the budget. So if you're not getting that information in committee, certainly want to make that offer that we're happy to do that.
That was a decision by MMB and not by the Department of Human Services. And I assume when the new budget comes, when the February forecast comes out, there'll be another presentation. Oh, and Doug Berg wanted to...
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald and members, just I mean, not to come to the department's rescue on this, but this has been an issue in every committee. There is a new budget system that went online recently. The format of the budget documents is different than it has been in the past, and there is a lot of sort of groping to find information at this point. The departments are not generally responsible for the format of the budget system that was put in place. They are the ones who end up picking up the pieces of providing you the information you actually want, and I think that's what Commissioner Leitz had mentioned, and I know the department, I've been in communication. If you have questions and data that you want from previous budgets or more detailed, the departments will endeavor to provide that for you. That said, there's a general dissatisfaction with the budget documents that have been produced in this budget, and it is, I think, largely related to moving to a new budget system that has just gone online.
Mr. Chairman? Thank you, Mr. Burke. Then I'll close with my follow-up. as a legislator, you all understand and recognize the importance of having information to us. And this job does not allow us to go outside and further investigate budgets. We're busy meeting with lobbyists and constituents and other committees, and it's simply this impossible for one human being to go up and above to go and disseminate information that's not proposed in front of us. The last 2 years, the budgets that we had gave us enough time to have the knowledge necessary to make an educated decision on bills and budgeting, and I'm very disappointed in an MMB that would go to such a method that would force us to have to spend even more time to investigate and look up the numbers. I think that's unfair to us, it's unfair to the state of Minnesota, and I hope that my ranting will make some difference in their decisions in the future. Thank you for the time, Chairman.
Thank you, Representative McDonald, and I agree with you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can you say that again?
No. Representative Hortman has something about the budget.
To this point, I hope that our fiscal staff will work with the department and the chairman to bring information to the committee in a way that we can understand it. I presume that the department doesn't use the information in the same format that MMB is presenting it to us in these budget documents. I presume that when the department is making decisions, they have better looking spreadsheets that are more informative. And it, you know, we had the same issue in Judiciary Finance yesterday. We would like to see what you see, because we're presumably what you're seeing in your work at the agency is intelligible, and what we're getting from this MMB process isn't really intelligible to us at this point. So to the extent you're bringing information from the department in a different format than what we're getting it from MMB, if it helps to tell the story so that we can make good decisions here, that our fiscal staff and the agency can work with the chair on bringing better information to the committee.
Yeah, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to, my question, or not question, but my comment when the commissioner was here and I was able to thank her on her way out, is that the nursing homes are finally included in the governor's budget for the first time. They opened the door to us, so we do have our toe in the door. I'd like it to be opened a little wider, but I am appreciative of the fact that we are in it. The percentages are not worked out yet. They still will be worked out, and I'll be bringing a bill to this committee again, asking for the rate increase to those nursing homes, and it's a good bipartisan bill. Look at my friend, Representative Schumacher, over there, who actually had some success last year. But it's bad that we've been cut and froze for 20 years. So we're actually in a budget this time specifically, so I'm grateful for that. Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, just to follow on Representative McDonald's comments, you know, I think you're, it's true, we need a lot of information, but I think maybe the couple things are causing difficulty here, at least from my point of view. One is that I wasn't really aware of the change and why it was being made, and I think maybe I missed it, but a little orientation to that might have been helpful. So maybe it's more of a rollout problem. Because I think they're striking a balance here between overload of information and intelligibility of information. And frankly, in my time here, I've always felt completely overwhelmed by the information. And I think too much is perhaps worse sometimes than not enough. So, you know, I think it's I certainly don't see here any intent to make our lives more difficult. I think it's an attempt to try to make it easier for us to grasp and perhaps for the public to grasp, which is something that I appreciate, but I think it's, you know, like all change, it can be a little difficult. So I think we kind of have to be a bit tolerant and sort of try to work together with MMB, and maybe the take back should just be that the rollout of this wasn't exactly smooth, and we need to understand better why they made the change and where they want us to go for the additional, or how they expect to get the additional information to us. But that said, I had some other questions, which is why I was on the list in the first place, and one of these, Mr. Leitz, is probably best directed to you, and that is about this new income calculation process under MA. I had a question from a constituent that I haven't yet heard the answer to, and that is, how does this work for people who don't file tax returns, which presumably would be a lot of the people who would be eligible for MA? if could you direct me there?
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, rather, and Representative Liebling, I'm going to start, and then I'm going to ask Karen Gibson, actually, to join me at the table, who oversees our eligibility area, who has a much more detailed knowledge of how this is going to work, just so we can get you, because I think that's a question a lot of folks are asking, is sort of, you know, if people don't file. We obviously will still need to collect information in those cases to make a determination of eligibility, and the standards that we'll use are similar or the same to do that, but we'll have to use a different data source in order to do that. And I don't know if Karen Gibson now has joined me, and she may be able to answer more clearly that process.
Chair, Representative Karen Gibson, Department of Human Services. Yes, a lot of our medical assistance eligible folks are below the tax income filing threshold, so they wouldn't necessarily need to do that. However, under the new income method that we are using, we will be trying to help them put together their income as, for the most part, as if they were filing a tax return, even though they aren't. So the new method does require us to follow the tax code with a few modifications. Just as we do now, people will be reporting, you know, to us, attesting to what their income is, and then we will verify that against electronic data sources. If they don't file, we won't be able to verify their income against the IRS database, but we are looking to put together other sources of electronic real-time data verification so that we can verify their income in that manner. So hopefully we can reduce the need for people to provide pay stubs, et cetera, and hang on to them and submit them, et cetera.
Representative Liebling.
So just to kind of bring this together and kind of allay the fears of some folks, that this is not something that's going to prove a greater impediment to those low-income people, correct? I mean, even though this is coming down to us from the feds, the idea is that people who are actually eligible should be able to get on the program.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay, next, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Lights, one of the things that we have to do in preparing a budget is to rely on forecasts that are very, very important. And we rely on our budget forecasts and our revenue forecasts that come in, as you know. And we also rely on eligibility forecasts through the departments that we use to determine what the budgets are going to be. And it is the more changes that we have, the more volatile those predictions become within the departments. One of the things that we are very concerned about is the accuracy of the eligibility predictions from the department in forecasting. Just looking backwards at the last biennium, the projected growths within those programs were off. They were wrong. We relied upon those predictions, and it turned out to be good news because the actual uptake within those programs was under forecast. However, if we were to push the rewind button, we would probably make a lot different decisions at the macro level about our budgeting process. If you just think about it in real terms, if you've got a $10 billion portion of a budget and you're 99% right, you can be $100 million off. And as we're looking across our different budget items, that's a big deal. I'm wondering what the governor's position is and what the department's position is on how we can become better at those forecasts. What are we currently doing in terms of practice within the department or within MMB, if that's the jurisdiction of oversight, of looking backwards that says, what did we predict? What actually happened? What can we do better to move forward in terms of getting a more accurate picture of what our programs are actually going to cost so that we don't make decisions at the macro level that really affect other programs like higher ed, like assistance to folks with disabilities, that once that train has left the station, it's 2 years until we can revisit it.
Commissioner Lights.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, you're, of course, absolutely right that the process that is used is a forecasting process, and the best information that we have at the time, I think, comes into Mr. Hoffman, who I think does has a pretty good track record of putting that information together. There's obviously, you know, margins for errors around forecasts are not always 100% accurate because it's predicting what the best expectations are for the future. I know that, you know, we're certainly always striving to improve that process. It's probably a question better posed somewhat to Mr. Hoffman on that, but I certainly will take that information back and that request back and make sure that the concern is heard within the agency around ensuring that those forecasts are as accurate as possible. I do know that that Mr. Hoffman certainly has, I think, a good history of doing this type of work, and certainly we will make sure he hears what the committee has discussed today.
Representative Dean, Mr. Hoffman is almost always very accurate. I think something happened last year or 2 years ago that he wasn't as accurate as he usually is, and we probably need to find out why that is. And maybe it was the economy. I don't know. But you had a follow-up question.
You know, Mr. Chair, and I know Mr. Hoffman has an excellent reputation, and his professionalism is beyond examination within that, but I'm just looking more from a systems-wide perspective through the department and moving ahead. And also, if Representative Gruenhagen doesn't point it out, I'm going to go ahead and point it out, that we are proposing adding 145,000 new people to the program in a cost-neutral basis. That's the way it's been presented to us. We're also being told that we're being able to pay for this from the federal government, which, by the way, is saying that they're doing this is going to save money over time. So under the heading of forecasting, I think that we have to really look at these macro numbers and project forward. Does the average constituent that we represent really believe that we can add 145,000 new people at a cost-neutral basis across Minnesota, increase access, and somehow that we're going to just provide care providers for these folks at the same or less dollars at the state level, while being told at the federal level that we absolutely positively will be spending less money on these programs over time? I just think that's a question that we need to ask ourselves as good stewards of our budget.
Okay, next, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I originally got on the list because I wanted to just make a request that as the department goes through these overviews, if in addition to highlighting the state impact, which, you know, is often highlighted and budget neutral and total and all those sorts of things, if you could also, for Representative Mack and I, who serve on the tax committee and are expected to bring from this committee insights as to what the property tax implications are, if you could also share what the impact would be on, you know, counties, cities, the criminal justice system. I know I've heard from my sheriff, who's concerned about increased jail costs when people are court ordered to the care of DHS and there isn't room at the inn. So just as you're going through the budget, that would be really helpful. Things like the 145,000 additional people, not all of those will be able to self apply, and what does that mean in terms of demand? I know that the counties have struggled with this bad economy, tons of people applying for public programs, whether it's food support or it's medical support, that they just don't normally see. And counties have often had hiring freezes during the recession because they've been struggling. So just if you can cover that, that would be great. But on your particular area, I would like to know, you say that hospitals are going to be able to do presumptive eligibility for MA, which I think is a great step forward. Is that limited in the federal law to just hospitals? I mean, now that we're training people and have evolved urgent care, can we bring them into that basket as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, the law has a requirement on that we allow hospitals to do that. Presumably, within states, you can also allow that optionally for other organizations. But we're complying up to the what the law requires in this piece of it.
Thank you,
Commissioner. I thought that hospitals could retroactively, in the current situation, could retroactively determine someone was eligible and get paid back later.
So, Mr. Chair, what this would be basically doing is at that point of care, making that determination as opposed to after the fact. So it's sort of a different way of getting at some of the same issues of determination. And on the presumptive side, it allows them sort of upfront to make that determination based on a basic kind of a core set of information that's collected.
And the last one is right now is Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's actually a follow-up to that presumptive eligibility. You mentioned that, if I heard you right, that if an incorrect assumption is made and it's found that they're not eligible down the road, the hospital is still able to get reimbursed and matching funds for that. And I guess my question is, just logistically, is there a built-in incentive for the hospital to make correct eligibility determinations or certain amount of strikes they get until, you know, they're maybe put on watch? I guess I just wonder, long term, it seems like there could be some problems with that system, and what incentive is there for providers to make accurate eligibility determinations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, I think as the system evolves, I think the goal will be to actually have people determined whether they're at, you know, hard determinations as to their eligibility before they hit the hospital. I think in the interim period here, as we bring online the new eligibility determination rules and systems, I think that's where the presumptive piece comes into play, because not everyone will necessarily have all their determinations made at the time they hit point of care. I think over time that'll become less of an issue. I do understand the point that you're raising, which is it in the incentive of a caregiving facility to make a determination for recognition of being eligible? And, you know, I think the hospitals in Minnesota typically, you know, are very good about these things. They will follow the kind of guidelines that are set out for this. It's not no information that's collected. It's more of a baseline set of information. So they do have to collect some information and do a good faith determination at the point of care. Understand your point, but I do think that over time that will become perhaps less of an issue as more people have hard determinations on their eligibility.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I had to step out. I had some constituents here from my district for a little bit, so I'm not quite sure where this question would be appropriate. If it is here, it should be for another speaker. But under the governor's changes, this packet here, there's a nursing home facility rate increase and quality add-on. Is this the place I can ask this question, or is it for a different speaker?
That would be Lauren Coleman. He'll be here. We're going to be going over the budget in detail all next week.
Oh, okay. So I'll wait on that question then. All right, thank you.
I mean, you're, again, normally we would have what they're getting this year, and we could see what the percentage-wise what the increase is, but unless you want to go back and get the 2012 budget.
I'll ask my question, Commissioner Leitz, and Leitz, okay. I'm being corrected here, not by my wife, but by a friendly person. I'm used to my wife, Greg. No. It's on page 12. It's about a $31 million increase for the biennium. And, you know, being in a rural district, I have a lot of nursing homes that are really having a problem with that rate equalization. And from the standpoint of their costs going up, and yet their any type of revenue seems to be frozen or not moving at all. But I see in the governor's budget he's going to provide some nursing facility rate increase and quality add-on. Am I understanding that correctly? Would that affect the rate equalization payments to nursing homes? And I see there's a quality add-on payment rewards, and I guess I'd just like a little bit more information on that, because I've been contacted by some of my rural nursing homes regarding this part of the budget.
Commissioner Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, Assistant Commissioner Coleman will be better able to answer those questions,
okay.
But we'll make sure he's prepared to answer those when he comes before the committee based on what you've asked.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes left, so Commissioner, continue.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chair. The next item in the governor's budget, in our fast yellow sheets here, Fast Act Review, page 4, and this relates to sort of the future of Minnesota Care. We've operated the Minnesota Care program in Minnesota since 1992. It's a program that we've operated under a Medicaid waiver, which means we receive matching funds on the program from the federal government. And it covers folks up to $275 of poverty if they're parents or kids, $250 of poverty if they're single adult populations. Many of these populations will be eligible for enrollment through the health insurance exchange, but we, as Commissioner Jessen mentioned, we've been working closely over the course of the past month or so with the federal government around what the future of this group should be for Minnesota Care. And I think it's the governor's intention that we would continue the Minnesota Care program, which has been a successful program for the state over time. And to fund that program, we would like to use an option within the Affordable Care Act called the Basic Health Plan option, which allows states to receive 95% of the funding that people would have otherwise received had they been enrolled in the health insurance exchange and purchased their coverage there. We really see that as the optimal funding source to be able to continue Minnesota Care and improve it in moving forward. Some of the improvements that we're looking at for Minnesota Care would be things like eliminating the $10,000 hospital cap, eliminating the 4-month waiting period that's on the program now, the $1,000 copay for inpatient hospital services. We're in a process now, and I think the commissioner mentioned that she and the governor would be meeting with Secretary Sebelius in the coming days on this. We haven't been able to receive any guidance from the federal government around how we can implement the basic health plan option and bring in this funding to be able to continue what we see as a very successful state-based program. And so what we see on this budget page is really a placeholder that says we're having those conversations. There is a contingency built in of about $300 million from the Healthcare Access Fund to kind of set aside, depending on the result of those conversations with the federal government. As we receive guidance, we'll be able to bring more information before you and have much more precise estimates around kind of what the costs will be and what the future of the program looks like. But right now, this page kind of encompasses that discussion as well as sort of this contingency which has been put aside. Mr. Chair, the next page is page 6 of the yellow document, which is entitled, which is really related to changes that we're making in our healthcare purchasing efforts. The first item on there corresponds to page 6 of the governor's change pages, which is the last item, managed care organization contract savings. In the 2011 budget, the legislature capped growth in managed care contracts that we administer at the department. Most of the people enrolled in Medicaid or in Minnesota Care enroll through managed care organizations, and we pay them a capitation rate on a monthly basis to serve our clients. Legislature capped the growth of those managed care contracts into the future at a 2% rate for this biennium. When we negotiated our contracts for calendar year 2013 with the managed care plans, we were able to actually negotiate rates which were flat as opposed to having a 2% growth in those contracts. And so the savings that we achieve relative to the 2% forecast amount is really what shows up as savings in this budget item. So this item really reflects that savings from the contracts that we negotiated this past year. The second item on this page, on the yellow page, relates to page 8 of the governor's budget. Change page is the last item, which is the 340B drug discount program. This is a a drug discount program administered through the Federal Health Resources and Services Administration, and a number of the safety net hospitals are eligible and clinics are eligible to participate in this program, and they're able to buy the drugs that they deliver to their people receiving services at their facility at a discounted rate. We aren't allowed for drugs that are purchased through 340B to receive any drug rebate on those drugs. So one of the ways that we get money within the Medicaid program is that for the drugs that we pay for, we get rebates from manufacturers. 340B drugs are ineligible for that rebate. In the past, for organizations that were part of 340B, we've negotiated a rate with them. So they buy the drugs at a certain discounted rate, and they agree to submit claims to us at a reduced rate. So it built in some margin for them, but they were still receiving their drugs at a discount. The intent of that agreement, the agreements that we had with them, was to really hold us harmless as DHS or the Medicaid program from what the rebates would have otherwise been, since we're unable to claim the rebates. But there have now become a lot more 340B entities who are eligible to be part of that program, and so it's become unworkable for us to have individual agreements with all of the organizations. Plus, the rebate amount that's available now has become much greater. And so as a result, we're actually paying more for 340B discounted drugs than we are for just standard drugs that we would purchase through community pharmacies, net of the rebate that we receive. So what this proposal does is to sort of try to remedy that by establishing a single uniform rate that we would pay for 340B acquired drugs. It's based on a nationally available benchmark, wholesale acquisition cost. The rate that we propose is set at a level that holds the Medicaid program harmless from what in aggregate would have been the rebates that we would have received on those drugs if we'd purchased them through normal channels, while also allowing for some margin for the organizations who are purchasing the drugs at a discount. We think that would allow them to be able to get a little bit of margin while also saving the state some money, and we believe the savings on this is about $5.2 million over the biennium. Third item relates to the a proposal to lower the cost of diabetic testing supplies. This is on page 7 of the governor's change page is the bottom item. We recommend implementing a bulk purchasing program for diabetic test strips by deeming certain brands as preferred brands, and then allowing for other brands to be available to individuals, but doing so on a prior authorization basis. And this, the savings from this item is a little over $500 million over the biennium. The next item is for providers. It's a proposal to reimburse providers for clinically administered drugs at the state allowable maximum cost. That is at the top of page 8 of the governor's change pages. We currently establish a pricing which is called the state maximum allowable cost to cover drugs that are administered at a pharmacy level. When those same drugs are administered in a clinic, we don't apply the state maximum allowable cost, so that creates an incentive actually for drugs to be administered in more costly settings. And what this proposal does, it's a modest proposal, but basically extends that state maximum allowable cost to clinical settings as well as in pharmacies as to the amount that we will reimburse for drugs, and saves about $50,000 over the biennium. And then the final proposal on this page is the yellow page, page 6, is a proposal to recalculate our child and teen checkup rate. This is a global rate that we pay to clinics when they do a core set of services that are child and teen checkup related. One of the things one of the things in that global rate is the cost of is vaccines. What we discovered is that there are certain drugs that are, or certain vaccines that are actually acquired by physician clinics at no cost. Vaccines that are acquired through the Vaccines for Kids program, is a federal program, and there's no cost to those vaccines to the clinic. However, we did find there were some billed charges related to those vaccines built into our rate for the child and teen checkup. So what this does is to remove those charges from that global rate. When we calculated the global rate, we rolled up a bunch of stuff into it, included some of those charges. We're simply removing those. It'll lower the global rate from around $300 to around $275.
Okay, well, we're just about out of time, and Commissioner, we'll see you next week again, I think. And Mr. Berg had something to inform us on.
Mr. Chair and members, just not to get us further in the weeds or beat a dead horse on the information issue, I'll probably do both at this point, but maybe this would have been better at the start. But just to give members a very brief idea of the flow of information and what you have. What are referred to as the governor's change page is the white document. You have the narrative document as part of the governor's budget rollout. I believe next week you'll be getting a folder that also has the fiscal pages and the agency background with that. There's limited information in this. I think the fiscal pages will also not satisfy a lot of members' questions. The yellow pages are DHS's attempt to add detail to these. If you are looking at these and you have a question about what are in these change items, try to scan the DHS stuff. It has more information, and then you can get back to the staff or the agency for further detail. Also, on the subject of spreadsheets, in your packet there is a thing called the 2013 Session Governor Budget Proposal Tracking. This has got all the governor's proposals and will in the future have the legislative proposals at a high level of detail on from a fiscal perspective. It'll have appropriations, savings and expenditures, revenues by fund, by year, and by budget activity. So you will, there's a lot of detail in here. It's a complicated document. It has probably more detail than members typically want. Representative Hortman had sent me a note asking whether, and I will say that I produce a sheet, and typically in each fiscal committee, the fiscal staff produce a sheet that looks at percentage changes from biennium to biennium on what we would call more a fund balance perspective or an account level. So I'll produce something for you next week that'll show the governor's budget by, you know, a percentage change from the previous biennium by department, and then take that down typically in an agency like DHS to the general fund balance level, which would be programmatically like MA and group residential housing, general assistance, MFIP, the various fund balance programmatic stuff, and I'll provide that to you. If you look at this sheet, and I draw it to your attention because you will see this spreadsheet again. This has been developed over a long period of time between the agencies and the legislative branch. It's the tool we use to do the tracking and to produce the appropriation document. As I mentioned, it's got a lot of detail, so if you get lost in it, you can talk to either the agency or myself about it. But just realize that at the end of the session, you will have this document, which will represent the product of this committee in an appropriation bill. So this is, it's got a lot in it, but it's a complicated document.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Berg. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.